Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'd like to call our session to order. My name is Mark Medish. I'm Vice President of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And on behalf of our President, Jessica Matthews, who couldn't be with us this morning, I'd like to welcome all of you. Thank you so much for sharing your morning with us. This is the fourth debate in Carnegie's series, Reframing China Policy. What a great room we have to meet in. I'd like to thank Senator Chuck Hagel for sponsoring and hosting us here today. The purpose of our debate series is to try to bring together the best and brightest minds on China to get the facts straight and to think through the arguments together with a view to sharpening U.S. understanding of U.S. policy options. The goal here is to have a spirited deliberation. We're very grateful to our corporate sponsor, GE, for its support for this series. Previous topics of the debate series were the sustainability of the Communist Party rule in China, the sustainability of China's high rates of economic growth in the long term, and implications of China's military modernization for U.S. policy. Today, we turn to the issue of human rights in China. The specific proposition to be discussed is whether U.S. engagement with China has produced a significant improvement in the human rights situation there. As we know, it may be an inevitable feature of U.S. foreign policy in dealing with any major power that we have multiple strategic objectives: security, commercial, trade, economic, human rights, democracy promotion, based on U.S. national security interests and U.S. national values. We also know that U.S. policy can't be one-dimensional. The question is, where do we strike the balance among these interests and values? What kind of engagement do we pursue at any given time and over time? Equally fundamental and related questions are, with respect to human rights, what leverage do we actually have? What is our toolbox from running the spectrum of norm setting, sanctions or the threat of sanctions, high-level dialogue, grassroots exchanges, promotion of the rule of law and civil society? And what has been our track record in using those tools in the case of China? In short, how can we effectively promote our values without jeopardizing our other interests? To help us navigate these questions, we've invited two of the country's leading experts on human rights in China, Professor Sharon Hom, formerly of NYU Law School and now the head of an NGO called Human Rights in China, and Professor Jacques Delisle of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. You'll see their full bios in the pamphlets on your chairs. Without further ado, I'm going to turn this session over to our moderator, Dr. Minxin Pei, who is the director of Carnegie's China program and author of China's Trap Transition. He'll provide further introductory remarks and lay out the ground rules. Minxin?
Thank you very much, Mark. Before I lay out the ground rules, I would like to announce the next two debates. The one in mid to late April will focus on the issue of whether China seeks to displace the U.S. as the dominant power in East Asia. Then following that, on May 14th, we will have a debate on China's role as a global trader, whether China's trade practices warrant tougher response from the West. If you want to stay in touch with us on the debate series and learn more about our debates, please leave your business cards on your way out after the debate or write down your contact information on the sign-up sheet. The format of today's debate is this. Each speaker will start with a 7-minute opening statement. then the three of us will engage in a discussion of about four or five issues that will last for 30 minutes. Then we will open up the floor for questions. But for the sake of efficiency, we ask that you write down your questions on the piece of on the index card we've left on your chairs and pass them along. That will go on for about 40 minutes. We will end around 11:30, 11:35. So the first speaker who will start this debate is Chuck Delisle, a good friend of mine and a former classmate. Chuck.
Thank you, Minxin, and thank all of you for coming. We are engaged in a debate here today, and I hope that Sharon and I will disagree more on substance than we did on wardrobe choice, apparently. This is not coordinated. We just happen to dress the same. Yes, so if you have a skirt, yes, I try not to do that. It tends to undermine my credibility. Anyway, time is brief, so I will try to get through my points in relatively short order. As is often true of academics, I didn't have time to write a short paper, so I wrote a long one, and I'll try to give it in brief form. Much of what we've been asked to address here, I think, has fairly obvious answers. There's very little doubt that human rights conditions in China remain inadequate and in some respects utterly abysmal. Nonetheless, they are a lot better than they used to be. They've improved greatly from at least long-term baselines of the late Mao years or the Tiananmen years. And across the board, there's been improvement, but it's been uneven. Economic and social rights have made significant progress. Political freedoms, at least in the sense of freedoms from and some limited freedoms to, have increased considerably, although they remain quite limited. And there's been significant progress toward, although not all the way to, the rule of law. There are now media and academic outlets for critics of the regime in a way that was unimaginable a generation ago, critics from the liberalization right as well as critics from China's new left. There are gadflies and mavericks who now dot the Chinese political and legal landscape who were unimaginable a generation ago. Not as dramatic, not as promising perhaps as the mass movements for political change that we saw in the 1980s, but in some ways by their very multifaceted and varied and diffuse character in some ways more effective. That said, of course, the story is not a simple one. Progress has not been uneven. It's been quite lacking in some vital areas, particularly political speech, political participation, religion, and criminal justice. And progress has not been linear. We were all familiar with the major setbacks of 1989 and the quashing of the Tiananmen incident, but there were other minor reversals before that, things like the anti-spiritual pollution campaign and the anti-bourgeois liberalization campaign. And of course, the 1990s and our current decade have brought setbacks as well. Falun Gong crackdowns on house churches, strike hard campaigns against crime, and various other such undertakings. And even in the most recent years, the Hu Jintao years in power, there have been some disturbing signs of retrogression. Intellectuals in China generally report a chilled atmosphere for their ideas. There's been a significant restriction, indeed rising restriction on the media, particularly new media. And there remain serious limits to the development of the legal system, including recently some dark noises from Luo Gan and others about the infiltration of foreign ideas and other efforts to possibly harm China through the legal system and through the open media, through the use of China's own legal system. And of course, the SARS crisis, for all that it gained us in the way of transparency, did bring forth some darker sides of, for example, harsh punishments for those who revealed false or spread false information and so on. Still, the long-term trend line is quite clear, and it at least correlates with the U.S. policy of engagement. U.S. policies of engagement, of course, began roughly around the time of normalization, which coincided with the beginning of reforms in China, and a second wave in the early 1990s, the post-Tiananmen restarting of reform in China, coincides with a deepening of U.S. engagement during the Clinton and George W. Bush years, a deepened engagement brought about by a burgeoning economic relationship and by a new placing of human rights on the agenda of U.S. policy in a way that I would argue was previously obscured by Cold War concerns and by the inattention to what was going on in China that was more sustainable before Tiananmen than afterwards. As to engagement, well, there are two macro dimensions, I think, that frame it that are worth keeping in mind. Since the early 1990s, China has engaged the international human rights order and has done so largely on its own terms. China now discusses human rights in terms of a universal list of human rights. It has joined the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights and has signed and promises to ratify the Civil and Political Rights Covenant. This shift, to be sure, has been tactical. Part of what brought it into place was the reaction to what happened at Tiananmen and afterwards and exposing human rights conditions in China. Nonetheless, it matters. Because China has now signed on to and engaged in this process, it now makes its reports and now issues its own white papers in terms that are no longer arguing about whether human rights are universal or what the list of human rights should look like. And there is something costly and unpleasant and exerting moderate pressure for change of having to talk in those terms. To put it in lawyers' words, and there are lots of lawyers and lots of lawyerliness in the business of human rights, we're no longer arguing about the law, at least not in detail. We're arguing about the facts and how the law applies to facts. The other aspect of engagement, of course, is the economic engagement. And here the link to human rights is indirect but profound. Opening to the outside world has been a driver for China's breathtaking economic growth rates, and that has, of course, led to direct gains for many hundreds of millions of Chinese in terms of their economic and social well-being. And if various venerable theories of social science are at all right, it creates a long-term pressure toward greater civil and political liberties. It also creates that open door through which, in the words of conservative Chinese leaders from the 80s, flies can come in. A lot of ideas, human rights ideas, directly human rights ideas, and other ideas with longer term implications for human rights flow through the channels of education, investment, professional and personal ties, and so on. Now, I'd like to go into a few aspects of engagement in practice and what I think has worked and not worked within this broader framework. And I would suggest that if you go through the pattern of what has worked relatively well and worked relatively badly, that you can see that the greatest progress has come, or the greatest impacts have come, where what the U.S. agenda has been has appeared relatively apolitical, where the models or advice that we've been pushing have been prestigious with Chinese audiences, where the issues on which we have focused are ones on which the U.S. can sustain a relatively moderate degree of pressure on China. And things have succeeded relatively well where the projects and undertakings have found willing and influential partners in China. This is partly a matter of what human rights issues one focuses on, what subset, and it's partly a matter of what means or vehicles one uses to pursue them. The more governmental, in some ways, the more problematic for some of the tougher issues. And just to give a quick inventory, how am I doing on time, by the way? I've lost track.
You're doing fine.
Okay, well, what does that mean? Okay, no problem. All right. Just to go through them, core human rights issues are pressed effectively in relatively narrow ways. Retail prisoner release works reasonably well. Ongoing bilateral discussions about trimming at the margins, improving things at the margin, work fairly well. Programs to increase civil society, to build civil society and strengthen and improve the accountability of institutions of governance. Programs to improve China's economic regulation, the laws that govern market-oriented behavior. Educational, scholarly, and professional exchanges are another important channel for the diffusion of ideas about human rights, and perhaps more importantly, providing support for like-minded Chinese, both through providing external endorsement, foreign endorsement of the ideas they push, through providing a degree of political cover and insulation that comes from having people who look like me anyway show up at some of these conferences and say nothing new, but nonetheless provide a certain degree of political cover. And finally, international visibility, the idea that these people are then on the radar screen and therefore likely to wind up on the list of individuals about whom the U.S. government and NGOs will be concerned and pay attention. More hardline approaches also work to some degree. Sometimes this works even in the government-to-government context when you pick the issues that it's really hard to push back on. Torture is probably the easiest example. But most of the harder line approaches, these be more critical, less engagement-oriented approaches, work better in private hands, NGOs like Sharon's. Now, part of this is sort of a story about what I think has worked and what hasn't. Let me close with saying something about why I think a harder line does not work terribly well prospectively, and this is a somewhat pessimistic view, although not entirely. First, a harder line from U.S. government policy risks compromising the acoustical separation that has allowed harder lines to be pursued effectively and with more response and engagement from the Chinese side through mechanisms varying from the congressionally chartered commissions that focus on China to private suits under the Alien Tort Statutes and through the work of some NGOs. Secondly, the U.S.'s capacity and will to press China for greater change is quite suspect and questionable. We never used MFN removal as a sanction in the bad old days, and the idea that anything like that would happen now strikes me as far-fetched, given the alignment of political interest groups and assessments of the national interests. The U.S.'s hard power is committed elsewhere, not that we'd use it vis-a-vis China under these circumstances, but it does have its collateral effects. And the U.S.'s soft power is waning. We are no longer the human rights city on the hill in the view of much of the world that we had been earlier. Thirdly, China's capacity and will to resist has increased. Economic power, some of it turned to military modernization as part of the story. And the ideology behind, the ideology of this power and these resources have been put behind is distinctly rejecting in many ways of deep engagement or deeper engagement with human rights. Strong sovereignty notions, which we see on display in the venerable five principles of peaceful coexistence, the critique of NATO intervention in Yugoslavia, the recent tussle over Darfur, discussions of peaceful evolution, all of these are ideologies of pushing back. Coupled to that increasingly is Chinese nationalism, which substitutes for a discredited socialism and an increasingly shaky reliance on economic performance legitimacy. Finally, unrest fears of the social instability that economic inequality and insecurity are breeding in China, has led to, I think, on balance, a certain wariness, a greater wariness in the regime toward the kinds of human rights improvement that would be a freer media and freer expression, and in some respects, more political participation. And so what I would say in respect to all of that is the likelihood that a U.S. policy that is harder line would be effective is quite questionable. It would have collateral negative costs for some of the other means that have been effective, and it would take a lot more than we are likely to be willing or able to put into it to press China. So we are better off, I think, in many ways, relying on the variety of channels, including engagement by the government and harder lines from other sectors that might, in some ways, echo Mao's dictum of letting 100 flowers bloom. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are odd stickies here. Okay. Great. Good morning. Thank you very much. I want to first thank Carnegie for inviting us. This is what happens when you're an NGO. You start speaking in the royal we. It never becomes thanking for inviting me. It becomes us, but because it is, none of the work is ever individual. I wanted to start by saying that the answer to the question is really not simple. Because there are just, when we ask the question whether U.S. engagement has produced significant improvement, we're really walking into a minefield of methodological, political, and empirical questions. Questions of definitions, questions of benchmarking, questions of what are the timeframes, questions of indicators, what are the metrics? These are all complex, there's a body of work around this, and I find that when we often assess whether policies have produced improvements, we tend to talk about those policy assessments separate from a really rigorous metrics. The bottom line, even if we do solve all the questions about the considerable methodological and definitional questions, is there's a question that any useful assessment, you need to have accurate, comprehensive, and reliable information for there to be an assessment. Yet what we have in China is an ongoing censorship and information control. And this is maintained by a system, a comprehensive system of criminal, state security, state secrets laws, internet and media laws, state-of-the-art technology, and a highly effective police and security apparatus. So within these constraints, considerable constraints of information and methodology, one starting point I want to suggest. Current U.S. engagement, however defined, with China is not as effective as it needs to be or as it could be, and I think Jacques would agree with me there. In terms of not only the U.S. human rights policy basket, but also in terms of the trade and security baskets. This is just to sidestep, just for the moment, the yes-no debate, so we can focus on what I think really matters, and that is how to get greater traction for advancing human rights for 20% of the world's population through U.S. engagement. Now, while the focus of this policy framing is on the U.S. and China, in order for the U.S. policy to be more effective, it will be necessary first for the U.S. to engage more effectively with the rest of the world and really beyond a dangerous kind of unilateralism and go-it-alone arrogance that it has been accused of. And second, the U.S. must handle its human rights at home in a way that doesn't undermine its moral authority and legitimacy abroad. This may be rather Confucian of me, but the most effective way to influence others is to set the example through one's own behavior. We'll talk later on in my third point about specific suggestions for U.S. Engagement with China. Well, the status of human rights situation in China, Jacques has already listed some of the inventory. I want to quickly go through some of it. China's exponential growth and the lucrative potential of its huge market have largely shaped how international business and foreign governments have preferred convenient half-truths. That is the China economic miracle story, or the assumptions economic growth will inevitably lead to progress. That's what Jim Mann has called the soothing scenario. Now, and they prefer these convenient, I call them convenient half-truths, to grappling with really the messy realities of the Chinese human rights challenges, and that is, it's not even, it's not one China, it appears to be multiple Chinas at any given time, so it's really quite messy. And domestically, the post-Tiananmen, quote, bargain, unbargain of silence, that is, don't ask, get rich, never legitimate to begin with, is really breaking down under the pressure of endemic corruption, growing social inequality and unrest, serious environmental, public health, and social welfare challenges. And as documented by U.S. government, numerous U.S. government hearings and reports, including the State Department report about to be released tomorrow, many of you in this room I know have been working both in the other agencies, have been monitoring it. I think the overall consensus among all of the monitoring and the government reports is that the situation remains serious and it's deteriorating, and I just want to emphasize and highlight a few of these areas. The crackdown, the very serious detentions and crackdowns for journalists, human rights lawyers, Weichuan lawyers, Weichuan activists, internet activists, and non-sanctioned religious groups, the ongoing crackdowns in the Tibetan Autonomous Region, in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, these all continue to be serious. And what we're going to see is a government's hard line, and it will continue in the lead up both to the 17th Party Congress and the 2008 Olympics. The avenues to present grievances, both according to China, scholars' own assessments, as well as foreign, these avenues, particularly petitioning, are not effective and are being shut down, and though guaranteed in various parts of Chinese law, are being met with by police force. There have been some recent announcements which got everyone once again very excited that there'll be RTL reforms again and that there are death penalty reforms again. And most recently, the new regulations that did not get too much attention in the international media, that is the new regulation on how the Supreme Court will be managing their review of the death penalty cases. Looking at that, it's important at one level, that is, tinkering, when fundamentally the fundamental structure will be left intact, and that means there will be some real limits to any of these reforms, including the RTL reforms, which have now been tabled. The draft for the amendments of the RTL law has been approved by the State Council, it has been tabled for a first reading in October, and these need to be monitored not only for formal legislative advancements. They have to be monitored for the questions of what are the implementation mechanisms and monitoring and accountability mechanisms being built in up front. We have to ask those questions up front, not after the legislation or several years down the road. Rule of law issues. Within a framework that is very clearly maintains the supremacy of the Communist Party, the legal system being built is really not a rule of law, it's a rule by law. And that is the use of law to maintain political control through legislation, particularly even through the mass organs of the party, like the All China Lawyers Association, the All China Trade. 1 minute, and I have two more points. These all emphasize that for example, the All China Lawyers Association measures restrict representation of group cases, and these are really intended to keep a control on the way that law can be used. I'm going to skip over the long list of the other human rights problems, which I think most of you in this room, all of you in this room, are quite familiar with, to add this one. The past is not another country. The almost 18 years later, despite continuous demands by Chinese citizens, including Ding Zilin, one of the leaders of the Tiananmen Mothers, just last week we issued a press release, has been calling for a full public accounting, compensation, and the release of the hundreds that we are known to still be detained for crimes that are often non-existent, like counter-revolutionary. The silence around talking about Tiananmen, the refusal to look at Tiananmen, echoes the silence around this is the 50th anniversary of Fanyou. And so the anti-rightist movement, we can't talk about that either, because once we start talking about that, we're going to start about the Cultural Revolution, then we're going to start talking about June 4th can't be far behind. So we can't talk about rule of law and criminal justice and justice and social justice when we can't even talk about past abuses. You can't move forward if you're carrying this baggage. Ultimately, the fundamental changes that's going to advance human rights must and will emerge from inside China. But there are considerable obstacles to these domestic forces, because there are clear limits to what an authoritarian regime that fears a color revolution in its own backyard will allow. The current restrictions on foreign foundations, I don't know of one foundation yet who has made it through the new registration process. The university exchanges and other capacity building programs are quite sobering and need to be looked at more critically. There needs to be more nuance to some of the domestic processes underway, and there's a need for walking on two legs or three legs when we think of the internet. When I think of domestic guanay work, and we think of international, and you think of cyberspace, these are three interrelated realms. But we need to walk on three legs, because to put all the program baskets in one, all the program eggs in one basket, is very dangerous, especially in light of the fact that the Chinese government have no qualms about crushing all the eggs in the basket. Bottom line conclusion, has U.S. engagement with China contributed to promoting human rights? Well, a qualified no and a qualified yes would be equally true. Well, here's the good and bad news. It's not all about the U.S. The U.S. is not the only actor influencing or attempting to influence China's human rights records. The EU has been trying, the Canadians have been trying, the UN has been trying, on and on and on. China itself, both the government and the civil society actors, the think tanks, the lawyers, the scholars, they're all grappling with the question not of U.S. engagement, but how to promote greater human rights protections. Curiously, as China has become more engaged with the international community, both through the trade regimes and the UN regime and the international human rights regime, as China internationalizes its position, which absolutely has an influence on its domestic strategies, the U.S. has curiously moved away from an internationalizing of its strategies. So I want to suggest that as a policy reformulation, which I think we'll have more time to talk about in the Q&A, is that there really needs to be, in terms of thinking about toolbox, leverage, timing, we need to really look more at the international frame because of the considerable work being done. The last thing I want to say about timing is the Olympics. 2007, this is the countdown. The Chinese have chosen another countdown time, the 500-day countdown, and that will begin March 27th, 28th. So the Olympics is being presents enormous opportunities if you do not provide fodder for Chinese nationalism. So that means any Olympics-related strategy or campaign needs to very carefully target an area in which the U.S. can have leverage, but not subject itself or open itself to be vulnerable to charges of intervention. And in that respect, I think the area where you can have leverage is U.S. companies that are involved in providing services, legal services, IT, security. The whole security infrastructure is being built by foreign. The media, you would be interested to hear that Ogilvy has been retained to train the Chinese public security police in how to more softly deal with foreign media. So you have a tremendous amount of foreign actors, and this is where the U.S. government can have some leverage. It's media training, it's the legal services. As you know, Morrison Foerster represents on all the IPR issues. These are all U.S. based companies. So we, where the leverage can be, the IT companies is a good example of it, where the U.S. company might, where the U.S. government might have some leverage. How about on U.S. corporate actors too? Thank you. Thanks.
I'm now going to ask both of you to respond to a series of questions. The first question is, in terms of baseline trends, how would you compare today's situation in terms of human rights in China vis-a-vis the late 1990s or the late Jiang era? Do you think the current situation is a temporary setback, if you think it's worse, or do you think it's going to be a lasting feature of the current system, Jiang?
It is, in many ways, of course, the Hu era has been a step back from the Jiang era. Now, it's been a step back, most strikingly, for the people that most of us talk to most. That is, relatively reform-minded intellectuals have certainly felt the chill. It's harder to get certain ideas out there. There's press back against it. People who've been involved in things like the OHN, the rights protection movement, other human rights lawyers, those folks have definitely had a very tough time. The journalists or aiders of journalists have been, all that whole crowd has clearly encountered a great deal of difficulty. And I think the concern with social unrest has led to crackdowns on, obviously we know the rural protests and some of the urban protests. So in all those sort of most visible and most political areas, yes, it's bad news. I don't know that it means that the entire picture is quite that bad. I mean, the sustained growth, the increasing concern with redistribution or with sharing the fruits more broadly, I think is seriously meant because it is self-serving for a leadership that wants to remain in power. And I take on that front there to be some good signs. And then the other areas are like religion and such are a mixed bag. Is it likely to be a long-term one? I think the short-term prospects are fairly negative. I don't think there's that much pressure to get better in a lot of ways, for reasons that I said in my opening remarks. I don't think the U.S. is going to be terribly active in bringing a lot of pressure to bear. I think the concern about what this all means leads to a relatively harsh and reactive response within China. Populism is not democratic in any meaningful way, and certainly not rights protecting in any meaningful way. So all of that is part of it. Now the question is, what happens when you start coming out the other side? And there I think there is more hope, because there are all these long-term trends toward greater prosperity, toward greater openness to foreign ideas, and toward a real desire on the part of the leadership to be accepted as the leaders of a respectable country. I mean, Zelik used the stakeholder analogy. I think there's a Chinese parallel to that that resonates strongly. They don't like being told at some level that they're international outlaws, and Sharon does, and my hat is off to her for telling them that at other NGOs too, but it is something that I think, is to be in a position where you're vulnerable to that kind of criticism is costly in terms of long-term regime agendas. But I think that's several years out. That's not short-term.
Sharon?
Well, I have to reiterate. First, we don't know the full picture of both past and present because of the information about the environment, information about public health, information about death penalty numbers, information about executions, information about what's happening in the Tar, Tibet, Autonomous Region and the XUAR. We don't know information about toxic spills. We know it when it's, sort of like slips out. So we don't know a great deal. Information with respect to investigations, prosecutions, criminal cases, that's all considered state secrets at different levels, secret, highly secret, top secret. So in this kind of information comprehensive control system, the first thing is, the answer to that question is a qualified, we don't know the full picture, but bits and pieces sort of what we know. The trend, and I have to say that Human Rights in China's strategy is not to tell the Chinese government that they're outlaws. I think it's very important for us to encourage. We think it's very important to say, good, in the last 20 years, you have signed on to every single major treaty and ratified except for the ICCPR. That is with torture, women, racial discrimination, children, economic culture. Every one of them have been signed on to, which means we say that's great, because it means that they've agreed to report on their progress in these areas, work with international monitoring bodies. That is a good sign of progress. Then we try to, in our parallel NGO reports on each of these areas, which, by the way, if you look at the reports of all of these areas, beginning with 2001, the recommendations from CERD, for racial discrimination, across the board, the assessments have been first to applaud the Chinese for trying to do better and reporting better, and at the same time, numerous recommendations on legislative reform, amend the trade union law to have independent unions, adopt the definition of discrimination, because how can you have laws protecting women and ethnic groups and if you don't have a definition of discrimination? Across the board, none of those have been implemented. So that's part of what China wants to also say, that we are cooperating with international mechanisms. So that's another opportunity to say, great, you want to cooperate? One good first step is to implement these recommendations. That's also an example of what I meant by the U.S. internationalizing its strategies. Instead of trying to invent whole cloth recommendations that are U.S.-based, one way to get added traction is to say, this is not just the U.S. government, a bilateral recommendation. These are recommendations that are being made by independent international bodies to which the Chinese have voluntarily signed on to work with in terms of those developing norms. So that's the second thing. The third aspect that I would say about trends, which is quite alarming, is the rise in, for lack of a better English word, thug violence. That is, the rise in violence of criminal elements, particularly at the local level, that seems to be either with the condonance of the local government or with the local police just simply looking away. And this has resulted in lawyers being beat up, their witnesses being beat up, their families being beat up, and we're talking about a pretty high level of violence. So I think that does not bode well for the domestic picture, but that's really in tension with China's full court press to make sure that the coming out party, that the Olympics is going to be smooth, that, you know, Beijingers stop spitting, they learn to stand online, everybody learns English. You know, this is all part of the really getting ready with the public face for the Olympics, and the real concern should be really the year after and the year after that and the year after that.
Does the U.S. really have any leverage at this point in pressuring China? Because we talked about erosion of American soft power, China's increasing capabilities, skills, and so forth. So, Chuck, what do you think?
We still have real leverage, and we use real leverage in small ways, and I think use it in the areas where it's likely to be most effective often. And I share Sharon's view that in some cases we're too timid in terms of what we could undertake. But yeah, there are the small-scale successes there. I think there's a lot to be said for the lists of people we're particularly concerned about, raising individuals. As Sharon has said, exile is not improvement, but exile is better than sitting in a jail. And there is the hard to measure. I mean, Sharon's right about the poor information in many respects. But the great counterfactual it's hard to prove is people who wind up not being in as much trouble as they otherwise would have been. Because of the visibility of their activities and the sense that the U.S. and others are going to press on that. So I think in that small retail way, we make a difference. I think the ongoing dialogue with the human rights officer in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing is an important thing. I think visiting officials, assistant secretary level or even higher, raising these issues and keeping it on the agenda keeps the pressure up. And it's possible to keep that pressure up and to have leverage with it for some of the reasons that both Sharon and I have mentioned. That is, because China has now in principle signed on to all these standards, it's no longer possible to dismiss completely any criticism as being an impermissible interference in China's internal affairs or trying to force Western values on China. You say you signed the darn convention, we're talking about implementation. And that is a real shift that gives, again, marginal leverage. I think the other area where we have an impact is not one that government policy so much controls but can trade on. That is, there are certain aspects of what China is grappling with, not just within the regime but among reformers as well, where American models and advice have a lot of prestige. I mean, you see this particularly in the economic realm. And then the amount of economic law that has been borrowed, and economic policy too for that matter, has been borrowed from Anglo-American capitalism is extraordinary. I think there'll be huge problems implementing it because it's been borrowed almost too faithfully. But if you think there's a link between that and either the prosperity that creates demands for human rights or the the attitudes of autonomy that come with, you know, private economic activity and such. There's an important channel there, and it's possible to leverage that a bit more, to draw some of the linkages in a way that are not terribly threatening, but that the press what is essentially a Chinese desire, the regime desire, to get those gains and say, you know, look, we'll talk about it in purely technical terms and not flag too much that it has human rights implications, but count on that playing out. I think also we need to be realistic. We need to focus on areas where it is really possible to think about the U.S. government sustaining pressure. And we're better off on doing that where there's an economic link. It could be labor rights related to trade issues. But if you go after the things where you can get a temporary coalition together to go after some more politically charged right, and it's going to fall apart, that ultimately doesn't really do the trick. That's the yes answer. The no answer is, for all the reasons I said in my opening remarks, the macro international political power realignment matters. And it really, in some sense, our moment of maximum influence has passed, as our ability to at least temporarily to stand up for these principles has waned, and as China's ability and willingness to push back has waxed. Some of that may pass, but I doubt that much of it will. And then finally, I've given you the yes and the no. Let me give you the maybe. And as I said a few moments ago, the U.S. does remain, especially if it cooperates with its allies, something like the Bern Group and just with the EU in general, which I know Sharon's done a lot of work with, there is an ability to function as a gatekeeper to respectability and full inclusion in the international system. And that is something that can be used judiciously. And we saw it used really in the wake of Tiananmen. We've seen it used in the WTO context, where there is something that China wants and that it needs to get into the club, it needs to get some level of respectability. There's a way of saying, okay, but. And we saw some of that, I think, even with the not terribly effective but marginally useful pressure on Hu Jintao to admit that Darfur was an international concern rather than something that happened inside the black box of sovereignty.
The leverage issue.
The leverage issue. I think Jacques and I both agree it's a yes and no, that we still have leverage. In some ways, at the moment of opportunity when we had maximum, that the U.S. had maximum leverage, I agree, has there's a moment of which that has, that cake has been baked. Because in many ways, many of the clubs that China was seeking entry into, the Human Rights Council, the newest club, WTO, all of the major UN bodies in which WHO, UNESCO, China has successfully lobbied for and acquired major leadership positions. So it's inside the member of many of the clubs, so that the keeping them outside will be less of the kind of an incentive. However, why the U.S. has leverage is, despite lots of rhetorical saber rattling, the U.S. relationship with China is extremely important to China, no matter what they say publicly, whatever the rhetorics are. This relationship is just too important for it to not be peaceful and successful, not to mention the over $350 billion that China is holding in U.S. Treasury securities. You know, you just don't want, you know, your investment to go down the tube. So you do really, really want to preserve that relationship. The history is also, I think, with the U.S. predates the 1949, and really goes back both in terms of exchanges and particularly academic exchanges, really well back more than 100 years. Secondly, the tools for the leverage. There needs to be a balance that Mark was talking about, a balance. I think the balance is really between interventions that protect individuals, minimizing the human damage, the human cost, the human suffering, which is really important when we talk about human rights, and at the same time, not forgetting that the ultimate longer term is systemic structural reforms. Otherwise, we're constantly pulling people out of a river of which they constantly are falling in and drowning. And in that respect, that's the tricky part with these hostage releases. That I would say that maybe it's better for an individual to be exiled. I'm not sure, because if you look at individuals' experiences living in exile, it's really quite sad. They're isolated. They're not all successful. They're not able to make a difference anymore to the homeland to which we really care. I think those are really terrible costs. Furthermore, the people who have been exiled, like Rabia Kadir most recently, last year, our Tibetan cases that have been released, they have been accompanied by threats to family members, and in Rabia's case, her family and her children being harassed, beat up, and arrested. So I think that that's part of the deal, that yes, you can go abroad, but silence, you can't say anything, and they've actually been told, don't say anything because your family's here. So I think that that presents real problems for the individual releases. It's also clear that individual releases and cases, both individuals and lists, are something that the Chinese government is becoming less inclined to engage in. The U.S. models, I think that the U.S. models are more effective if we present it a little bit more humbly, along a menu, which is a menu of not just the U.S. model. Some very thoughtful Chinese legal scholars have said quite publicly, why are we looking to just the U.S. model? There are other models. Let's look at the European models, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the U.S. consciously presenting itself as part of a menu of choices and options would facilitate that rather than presenting the U.S. model as the model. And then finally, in terms of whether leverage, it would be to stop thinking about the and talking about China and strategizing about China as if it were monolithic. The reformer voices are not dead. They may, some of them are 90, and but they're not dead. There are other reformer voices. This is true within the party. This is even true within the lead up to the 17th Party Congress, which unfortunately, in the jockeying for power, tough guys are going to win. So nobody wants to sound like a softie. So there's going to be a lot of tough, posturing, but the 17th Congress is not the end of it. But I think it's important that in the engagement with China, the tendency is to engage with the MFA, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, in the trade area, with the trade ministries. I think two things need to happen with that. One is there needs to be more sharing. This might be quite radical. In the U.S. government side, from the various departments, labor, the U.S. Trade Rep's office, State Department, the different voices of that, I think it would be useful to have a little bit more strategic information sharing. Perhaps it happens, but because of the lack of transparency about that, I don't know. But if it's not happening, it needs to happen more. The other litmus test question about this leverage question is to ask, does a particular initiative promote and support more space for the reformer voices, whether in government, in the think tanks, or in the NGO sector? And that means creating space in a way that sometimes the envelope, I think, can be pushed a lot more than it's currently being pushed.
One more question. What should American corporations do? We know that American corporations wield enormous economic influence inside China, and what they do have direct impact on human rights conditions within China. But we also know that American corporations so far have been quite reluctant to speak out on this issue. Should the U.S. government take some measure to force American companies with business in China to take a different stance on human rights conditions there?
I think it's politically unlikely, and as a policy matter, probably a bit unwise. Corporate America is fairly effective at resisting calls to take any particular stand, particularly anything that sounds like you must take this position as a matter of almost a government-demanded speech. And we saw back in the, mostly in the 80s, where there were discussions of passing legislation that would have imposed codes of human rights-related conduct on U.S. corporations, and the move there was largely preemptive for corporations adopting their own policies. I mean, even in that somewhat more limited area, the legislative agenda was not easy to get through. I also worry that anything that has too many government fingerprints on it in terms of this is the position U.S. corporations shall take with respect to these issues is going to destroy what I referred to earlier as that acoustical separation. I think that it took a long time to drag Chinese leaders to the position of understanding that the U.S. was not a monolith in which private actors and all branches of government were somehow part of some anti-Chinese conspiracy. I mean, if you compare, for instance, the way China has handled the alien tort statute claims that have been brought by Falun Gong victims or by people complaining about prison labor or some Tiananmen dissidents, those kinds of claims, China now doesn't like it, but it understands that the courts are different from the executive and the private plaintiffs and the pro bono lawyers who are working for them. They're all part of this universe that the president can't really control. Compare that to the late 1970s when there was this demand that, darn it, the Taiwan Relations Act showed that the president didn't really mean it when he signed the normalization deal, and the Huguang Railway Bonds case was something that the president should have been able to stop. I mean, it took a little while to get that sorted out. Obviously, China's not going to go back to that, but you don't want to do anything that suggests those connections. That's not to say corporations shouldn't do anything, and I think they should do more than they have. But the most effective leverage, I think, the way they're going to get less pushback and have more effect, is first of all, easily, of course, to do things that are within their control, to really make sure that their own workers enjoy a certain degree of labor rights, and that they will look out for their workers if they run into human rights trouble with the authorities, to make sure their suppliers are living up to standards, that they can't just sort of outsource the human rights problem by having things produced elsewhere. And you know, Walmart in particular has a lot of leverage as a buyer for many, many Chinese suppliers. I know Sharon's worked somewhat on that issue. So there are those kinds of things. And I think they can make the case to the Chinese authorities that say, look, you guys want business, you want investment, you've got to understand that bad human rights is bad for business. And that's a perfectly plausible argument. And if nothing else, they can engage in a little bit of a two-level game, saying, look, back home, my shareholders are going to kill me. CalPERS doesn't like it if they have a big holding in some company that's dealing with a problematic regime. So it's these areas where they push somewhat around the margins, where it doesn't appear to be coordinated and government-steered, and where it at least starts with issues that are going to be accepted by Chinese authorities as legitimately within the realm of business and business-related concerns, that's good. The other thing that could be done is corporations could engage a little bit of sub-acoustical sort of separation by providing money to support human rights favorable activities, you know, scholarships or some such arrangement for Chinese human rights lawyers who want to go outside the country for a while, or scholars and such. That kind of thing I could imagine, you know, being a nice way of leveraging that.
I think that U.S. corporations and corporations in general have a great role to play in being able to promote human rights. But I think that to be effective, it needs to be a question that's thought about strategically in a very sectorally specific way. And so that's number one, it has to be sectoral and not just corporations across the board. Secondly, I think that both voluntary and regulatory approaches have to go hand in hand. And a good example of that is the IT example, that the hearings in February with respect to IT companies doing business, you know, the Hill 4 who were sweating. After sweating in the hearing, suddenly everyone became much more amenable to talking about, you know, voluntary and so there's right now we have been part of a multi-stakeholder process that just went public in January, and that was after 7 to 8 months of a private process, which involved which involves Microsoft, Google, and Yahoo in talking about two sets, and that is how to develop sets of guidelines for U.S. companies, IT companies, doing business in repressive regimes, sounds familiar, like the proposed legislation, to promote freedom of expression. And secondly, which is what the NGO stakeholders, including HRIC, push for, is that there needs to be implementation mechanisms, benchmarks, accountability, and we all want to be part of that process. So I think that there's a role to play. The third thing that can be said about how the U.S. Government can promote corporations is international developments. Earlier in February, Professor John Ruggie, the special representative on human rights and transnational corporations and other business entities for the UN, released his report on human rights and corporations, specifically addressing the methodological problems of how to measure human rights impacts and how we can promote that. And the framework lays out two key points, both the ways in which the human rights assessment for corporations parallels existing very well developed in the environmental area, environmental and social impact assessments, and secondly, how it has to be different and unique to human rights, which is that it has to be within a very rigorous doctrinal, technical human rights framework of standards, indicators, and a body of jurisprudence. That is a very important document, and I think that part of internationalizing U.S. thinking about it, I think drawing a page from that on how to engage corporations would be extremely useful, because it's getting traction from international developments that are getting a lot of attention right now.
Thanks. I'm going to leave
the IT companies, the Google, Yahoo, Microsoft issue is, I think, a particularly important one to focus on. And if you think of the spectrum of areas where we've had legislative responses and where we haven't, I mean, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, that's easy. Corporations don't like it, but it's easy to ban that. Banning things like providing services to the military or police and repressive regimes, including China's, that's a fairly easy one. At the other end of the spectrum, saying you should have the following set of human rights policies and position papers that you take, that's over there. The IT one strikes me as in the middle, and it strikes me as a quite plausible case for legislation to the extent that companies don't self-regulate in the shadow of that prospect, precisely because it strikes me as being very similar to selling, you know, weapons of torture or whatever to police state regimes. It really is a way of aiding a particular kind of repression rather than simply doing business in a country that has a bad human rights record and being in a much looser way complicit.
Can I also add to that that I think that a number of corporations, Gap, Ford, Walmart in process, have taken on lots of initiatives to think about how they can articulate either a direct, using the H word, human rights policy, as the Ford report has and as the Gap report tried, is that they also use proxies for human rights. So sustainability, labor rights. These are all human rights related, or labor rights are an aspect of human rights, but you're seeing a lot of development within corporations to do that. When you think about Walmart, China's sixth largest trading partner, and that if it were a country, it would be number 20 in the world, it could have enormous impact given that it just added another 101 factories last week in China. And every single supplier you can name is a Walmart supplier in China. So when you're talking about 1,000, over 1,200, 1,300, I think, or almost 1,400 plants in China, plus the supply chain, the potential for impact is enormous. So I wanted to underscore that.
Okay, now we go to the questions. We have your terrific questions. Thank you so much. And while we are on the theme of U.S. corporations, is this question. Does Ms. Hom have a strategy to shame U.S. companies who are failing, who are falling over each other into China to be more attentive to human rights?
Our strategy is not only to shame. It's not. It wasn't particularly effective in the 20th century, and we don't think that it's going to be, as a single strategy, going to be particularly effective in the 21st century, with governments or with corporations. So what really needs to happen is walking on two, three legs. Is that if you on our website, ir2008.org, we have a whole corporate strategy that's targeting, as we said, sectorally. So first thing when Google was disclosed to have been, you know, censoring their search engine results, you know, rather than saying shame on you, Google, we immediately said, hey, Google, not too late for corporate leadership. Here's something you can still do. So I think that what we're trying to do is developing a more nuanced NGO strategy, which includes both working with the corporations, the ones who will come to the table with us, and that is increasingly more and more of them. Secondly, to develop solutions, to be solution providers. I think it's very easy, you know, any, you know what, can knock down a barn. It's really hard to build one. And the problems of trying to build greater systemic protections for human rights as well as protecting individuals is enormously complex, and we think that as NGOs we should be part of thinking of those solutions. So some of those solutions include better information, better report. Some of the companies surprisingly tell us they really don't know what to do about the Olympics, and they actually ask point blank, what do you think we should be doing about the Olympics? And so we want to really engage in that process, to be constructive, to be in the dialogue, and then together, because if a solution comes from one source, it's not going to be effective. If it's going to be a corporate implementation, it has to be part of a solution that the stakeholders develop together and also monitor together. I hope I didn't evade the question, but I hope that was an answer.
Good. There's another one. It sounds like both speakers believe human rights can best be advanced by avoiding direct confrontational punitive American measures targeting China. What other measures? Are there other measures that work better?
Direct, I don't think there's a problem with. I mean, the U.S. State Department human rights reports are quite direct. People, you know, can quibble about the accuracy or tone. of the two congressional chartered commissions, the U.S. Congressional Executive Commission on China, which focuses extensively on human rights and law issues, and the U.S.-China Economic Security Review Commission, which has some of these issues in its portfolio, I think are quite direct. So even as government-related undertakings, those are part of the package. And of course, all the American-based or American-tied NGOs, which run a gamut from moderately critical to really quite harshly critical, are fairly direct confrontations. As to confrontation and government sanctions, I just don't think it's, well, a few things. One is I don't think it's very realistic. The U.S. has yet to show any real stomach for doing that. We saw what happened in the wake of Tiananmen, which is the one time we came close to denying MFN. That went away. And if anything, that is harder to do now for all of the shifts in the global environment that we've been talking about. And I think if we were even to work it up to do that briefly, we wouldn't stick with it. Just as a matter of politics. And I think that's actually a very dangerous game because it sends the message to Beijing that they can wait it out. And worse yet, it sends the messages to some of the more potentially bold reformers in China that things are going to get better and the U.S. is going to back them, and I don't think it will in the long run. So I think those are all reasons not to do it. That said, there's a lot of stuff you can do. You can be direct without imposing sanctions. You can work to bring collaborative pressure to bear multilaterally, which I think is likely to be more effective. But I think you can also just work to encourage those forces in China that are most likely to be moving in the right direction. Those kinds of things require access. They require some symbolic gestures. They really do require access. They require the human ties, the professional ties. They require the businesses on the ground, the scholarly exchanges, all of those kinds of things. The providing advice on how to reform China's laws in ways that will help village elections and civil society organizations and rule of law and legal aid and all these kinds of things. These are all nipping around the edges. It's frustratingly slow. It's hard to justify in terms of the people who suffer in the short run, but it is ultimately the best long-term hope because those changes will have to come ultimately from inside and because I frankly don't think we politically have the will or the ability to make a tougher line with some real sanctions behind it stick.
Any thoughts on this?
Well, I think the question would be that it's not whether to confront or not. I think it's when to be firm so that we can be effective, we being governments, business, and civil society. And so really the question is when to be really firm and send a firm message. And I think there are real opportunities to do that. For example, lifting of the arms embargo that had been levied in 89, whether to lift it or not, they sent a really clear message. One doesn't have to be hostile and confrontational. I think just send a very clear message. It was levied as related to Tiananmen, and if Tiananmen is not dealt with, it's not going to be lifted as the Europeans continue to debate. The second thing is that in the engagement with China, to be firm, one area which is very important to be firm about is the inclusion of independent civil society, both in the domestic Chinese processes and in the international processes. And by that I mean not only the civil society groups that are state-sanctioned and that are approved by the government. The EU government, with the exception of one EU-China human rights seminar meeting that we have been involved in, really stood quite firm, despite some objections and concerns by the Chinese government to the participation of human rights in China. And the EU stood very firm because to back down would send a very bad message about independent civil society, about the dangerousness of human rights, and about staying firm about who should be at the table and in the room. I want to say one thing about access. Access is extremely important to be able to get the data and to be there having the contacts. At the same time, I think access is a double-edged sword, and that in order to promote access for governments to have the access for foundations and for academics and researchers, access is important at the same time that access can also be the hostage holder, that in order to preserve that future access, there are limits that you must be very careful to tread or you'll be just kicked out. A very prominent, long-time China legal scholar and lawyer said to me last month, made a joke, and because I enlisted him in once again another human rights project of which he had done for, he's 40 years active, walked both lines, and he said, "Sharon, you're going to get me kicked out of China." I said, no, boo. I said, "I'm going to help work on a China that we all want to go back to." So I think that, that's an important thing to keep in mind. So the other thing about access is to not think about it to 20th century. What's happening is that in some respects, certain members of my staff are not allowed to go back. I was recently back in 2005, have not been back since. I probably will try to go back, hope I can be invited and allowed back. But I think that the thing about access in the 21st century, when you think about there's over 135 closing on 140 million online, 400 million cell phones, and the new kind of technology that's rippling, is through our newsletter and our e-activism project, we are reaching right now every single week between 500,000 to 750,000 subscribers to our uncensored newsletter. And that we are averaging monthly between 140 to, depending on the month, if there's a crackdown, to 200,000 unique IP users coming to us through the proxies, that is, they're coming from China. So I want to say that about access, there's a whole different way to think about it, in a more nuanced way, that there's, you know, I don't want to advocate Second Life, which I think is just incredibly bizarre to be living a second life when a lot of people in China, like 700 million people, don't even have a first life. You know, I think it's really important to, you know, really let's look at, you know, real time. But I do think that the cyberspace creates some important blurrings of inside, outside, and strategic opportunities. The other thing about access that's extremely important, and this is particularly true for my organization, is that in the last year and a half, we have seen an increase numerically and quantitatively and qualitatively in the number of contacts with scholars, NGOs, and yes, off-the-record government officials meeting with us off the record. And so that where we're not able to meet with them in country, we are now having lots of incredible and perhaps fuller discussions with these counterparts outside of China, and they also take back a lot of materials, which they, of course, will dump in Narita Airport. But it was a very interesting thing to read en route.
I'm going to say, in terms of just to underscore the access issue, two things. One is, it is important to understand two spectra here at CNC. One is a differential risk. It takes a lot, if you are truly non-Chinese in the authorities' view, to get yourself in very much trouble. Even getting banned has happened to relatively few foreign scholars and journals. It's happened to some far more than it should, but it's not that widespread. For people who are sitting on a Chinese passport, it's a very different world. And there is a distressing ability to track the spectrum of how much trouble you're in based by how secure your U.S. status is. You know, if you had no more contact with China than I did growing up, you're pretty fine. If you're a completely naturalized U.S. citizen, you're in good shape. If you've got a green card, that's a little less good. And if you just got a Chinese passport, you know, the risk that you're not going to run into more trouble is serious. And so people who, I think in some sense, those who are at the most secure end of the spectrum are too wary of their access, of the limits to their access, and should push the envelope further because the consequences are not that severe in most cases. The other thing is quality versus quantity of access, which is, Sharon's talking about the expansion of quantity of access, it's absolutely important. Quality, high quality access is vital as well, and I would just reinforce what Sharon said, the importance of keeping channels open so that people can get outside of China and have those conversations elsewhere, and not just have the conversations, but spend a lot of time out there. I mean, the contrast between, just to take the legal example, the lawyers I know who spent significant time outside of China being trained and practicing and going back, and the way they think of themselves and their roles and the role of law in their society versus those who really haven't gotten out is significant. Not in terms of how much they value certain values, but the sophistication with which they understand them and the importance to them of trying to press them, and I think how they press them. Those are just differences that it's very hard to replicate unless you have sustained immersing contact.
I want to underscore and support Jacques' comment that I think that many foreign actors and U.S. foreign actors are not really pushing the envelope enough, and there tends to be an incredible sensitivity, so that I often find alarmingly that it's the U.S. foreign actor who's saying, oh, don't say the human rights word. And that's so bizarre because China's saying the human rights word. They're issuing, you know, very strong white papers on the U.S. human rights record. Why are suddenly the foreign actors reluctant to use the H word? The second thing is that I would just put a caveat to what Jacques said about foreigners, is that I think ethnic Chinese of any, you know, green card holder, U.S. passport holder, my own personal experience, I think, underscored that, that ethnic Chinese, that we are disproportionately targeted. And I was quite shocked after I did my Asian Wall Street Journal op-ed piece in 2005 about my unfortunate incidents with the state secret police, that I received email from ethnic Chinese scholars around the country who were telling me what happened to them, which they could never talk about and did not want me to write about because they said that it was they were threatened after what happened. So I think that's extremely important to recognize that ethnic Chinese, do face some considerable risk. But having said that, I think that there's so much more that can be done for the foreign actors in China, because are they really going to throw out XX, so and so, and this program? And if they do, it will be not for the long term. I don't know if Jim Feinerman is sitting here, and if I can tell the story, Jim can throw a rock at me if he wants me to stop. But in the CLEEC program, the Committee for Legal Education Exchange with China, under Jim's watch, there was an infamous year in which the Chinese sent us, this is an annual program where we brought about 22 to 25 scholars to come to the U.S. to study. And there was a year when they sent all hacks, to be quite blunt. And so that, under Jim's chairmanship, we said no to every single one of them. And the Chinese were very upset, said we hurt their feelings, this was not a friendly act, this was the end of the program. They added to Jim's incredible welcome in China. I mean, this was just not a very a good experience. However, we held firm and we said we want qualified individuals. You can't have people going to the U.S. saying they're going to study when they can't speak English or have a research proposal that they can't read English. And we were also holding the line because they didn't want to allow anyone under 35. I think that was the year. And there were some wonderful, smart scholars they wouldn't let out. So no one came in that year, and that seemed bad. And then it recovered, and subsequently, we were involved, and we brought other classes in. The program got on track. The next batch that was sent had English, had real research proposals, were serious scholars. I mean, so I think one has to have the longer view about pushing the envelope. There may be some pushback, but you got to take the longer view to keep a real firm message.
This question. One could argue that a major obstacle to an effective U.S. policy to promote human rights in China has been the bitter politicization and division within the U.S. over human rights and China policy. What can we do to rebuild consensus on human rights and China policy in the U.S. and more broadly within the West?
Oh, hold on. I mean, 30 seconds or less, right?
Briefly.
Yes. there is a funny alignment on the human rights issue and the broader political spectrum. It's the sort of thing that should actually be healable. That is, it's not that human rights is a left issue or a right issue. They tend to emphasize different things. Obviously, religious freedom concerns have gotten somewhat more play on the right. Labor rights have gotten somewhat more play on the left. Political prisoners, some on both. And the other side of the divide has really been the business drives everything else, engagement at all costs, sweep the human rights under the carpet thing. But there are proponents of both views in both parties, in effect. So it may be one of those rare moments where bipartisanship could cross lines. As a tactical matter, what it seems to be the easy things to do are to pick the most fundamental rights, which no one much would object to. China has signed the Torture Convention. Torture still goes on. Who's going to endorse that? And focus on those things that actually will have some consensus. And those areas of sort of accidental consensus and maybe even some horse trading. I think there's a way of doing that. And I think there's something to be said for the pro-human rights wing of this debate. If the goal is to really rebuild consensus in some sense, to take the longer term view, to swallow hard and make the moderate arguments about how human rights is good for business and trying to make that kind of sell, I think that can work. I actually think it's been a relatively good development in American partisan politics in the last couple of election cycles that we haven't had the ritual, the party out of power bashes the party in power's China policy, particularly on human rights grounds. I mean, that obviously was something we had in every cycle really prior to the last couple. It was Clinton going after Bush 1, before that Reagan going after Carter, and so on down through the unfriendly takeovers, as it were. And that seems, China policy does not have that kind of salience, and so I think there's actually more possibility to build a consensus. And I think getting NGOs and businesses and such around the table as well, if you have more voices, there might be more of ability to heal the pursuit of partisan advantage, really.
Yeah.
Well, I think one way is to first pitch it as a good thing, that having some of the division and the debates within the U.S. government about China and human rights shows it's a good example of what happens in a government where there is democracy and where there can be difference and where policy debates can really be all-out, knockout, drag out publicly aired. So I think that's one thing, claim victory from the divisiveness. The second is promoting more crossover kinds of briefings and conversations so that the particular agencies are not functioning within their own realm of expertise and really doing a lot more of the crossover. This is both through, you know, some of the briefings as well as departmental. And then third, to echo what Jacques said about focusing on areas of concern where you're going to have more consensus, I think the real challenge is going to be that there'll be areas of consensus around issues and principles. You know, no one's going to be for torture. No one's going to be against freedom of expression. The real difficulty in building consensus are the pragmatics, is how to advance those principles and those values. And so, this discussion now about should PN, you know, TR be taken away from China, I mean, that's about a how question, and I think that will be divisive, and it's going to be harder to get consensus about the how question than the why question and the so what question.
Last question about leverage again. You all say that U.S. is having less leverage today than before. But that's because the U.S. tries to change the behavior of a regime. What about a new approach that targets individual violators of human rights in China? For example, the U.S. and its allies can keep a dossier on local officials who are directly responsible for human rights violations and then deny them visas to the West as punishment. How will that work?
Yeah. Well, we've done some things that are sort of like that, and they've been relatively effective. And to take the example from earlier in my remarks, there have been a series of these alien tort statute suits and Torture Victim Protection Act type suits, where basically the named defendants are individual Chinese leaders, in one case as high as Jiang Zemin, but also people substantially down the chain, I mean, mayor and below, where they've had some connection with the activities in question. And that clearly stings a bit. It gets a lot of publicity. You get a court statement that says, look, these cases rarely lead to a judgment in plaintiff's favor, but that's not really what they're about. It'd be nice to get some money. The real point is to air these things in a high-profile way. So I think that sort of thing has been effective. It clearly does sting. It has its impact without disrupting the broader bilateral relationship. And to the extent that you've got local officials who definitely want, or any officials who definitely want access to the U.S., you are hitting them where it hurts. Seizing somebody's foreign bank account, in effect, and some of that same kind of personal denial of a benefit. And I think in some ways it's, of course, symmetrical with what has been the relatively successful retail strategy of focusing on individuals who've been targeted by the Chinese regime. It's a nice mirror image to that. I think it's absolutely worth doing. And it has the other advantage of, in at least some cases, if you don't go too high up the chain, perhaps resonating with things that the top levels of the regime are not going to repudiate. That is, China's leaders know they have a problem and will say they have a problem with abusive behavior by local officials. And they're not going to be too keen on the U.S. Necessarily going out and prosecuting people. We're not talking about that. We're saying you don't get a visa. Well, so what? In some sense, that's less a thumb in the eye. So that's all to the good. Is it going to profoundly change things? I doubt it, but every little bit helps, and I don't see much of a downside to it.
I think that first, saying that the U.S. current policy does not have enough, is not as effective as it needs to be and as it could be, is not the same thing as saying that it has less impact. So I want to say what I'm saying is that it needs to be more effective. That's not the same thing as saying it's less effective and less leverage. Now, on individuals, targeting individuals, the human rights violations and abuses and challenges are not only the result of individual actions. So targeting individuals is important from the perspective of accountability, from the perspective of accountability of individual decision makers or of the decision-making process, and it will promote accountability, but it will not necessarily address the other part of it, which is the constructive part of the work that needs to be done, which is how to create the conditions for advancing human rights, the conditions and a culture that will respect human rights and build a rule of law. So on that part, the prosecution avenue will not do that. However, I do think there needs to be both these individual, legal, prosecuting, constructive, building, capacity building. They all really need to happen together. What's not happening enough is how they mutually inform each other. The capacity building and the constructive parts of the agenda tends to be divorced from the human rights monitoring and that part of the work. This is also true for the UN. It's not just the US government. It's true for the US Office of the High Commissioner. There tends to be a little bit of a divergence between the monitoring function and the other function.
Okay, we can stay on and
do we have a closing sentence?
I want to end on a sort of bright note.
Okay.
That is, other than the Olympics, do you see any opportunities for the US to make a bigger difference than it makes today in the next 5 years? You mentioned the Olympics.
The Olympics, of course, is the one everyone focuses on.
There
will be things inevitably that will come up. It's hard to predict what they are. Things that are calendared. A presidential changeover is always an opportunity to articulate a new China policy. And clearly we're going to have a change of presidents and something that is a more dramatic shift than a sitting vice president becoming a president. So even if there's, whether or not there's a switch in parties, that's always a moment. And the Chinese always watch that very carefully. They're always very concerned about what's going to come out. So there are opportunities to deal with that, especially if it can be insulated from the campaign politics, which again, as I said earlier, are not looking like it's going to be terribly human rights or politics toward China focused. There is, it's the old Wei Ji there, the conjunction of opportunity and danger. The Taiwanese presidential elections, I think, are going to be an occasion where there's going to be a lot in play. And obviously what's going on in Taiwan strongly resonates with human rights issues in China, and you can imagine that playing out in one form or another. There is significant talk, of course, of pressing China harder in the WTO, actually bringing a case probably on IPR, but there are a number of others as well, pressing farther than we have so far. And as the WTO mission creep into more rights-related issues and the possibilities of linkage come up, I could see that presenting an opportunity for some leverage because it does hit China where it really matters. If we have not yet fully worked out, which I don't think we have, what to do with the American companies in the new technology areas, the Yahoo, Google kinds of issues, where the rub between business and human rights issues is sharper than it's been at any time since American firms first started going into investing in manufacturing plants in China a generation ago. That's another possible area. And again, I'm sure that probably the most likely or the most promising ones are things we just don't know about yet. It'll be something that happens in the world.
Then just very quickly, I think the Olympics are important, and it's important not to lose the opportunity of the Olympics because we're looking for something even better. It's kind of like asking Mrs. Lincoln, except for that, did you enjoy the show? Well, that was the whole thing. You can't miss the whole day thing. So I think that the Chinese government, Chinese civil society, they're all looking at the Olympics, and that would be such an incredible missed opportunity. Do you know that even animal activists, believe it or not, that are beginning, are using the Olympics so that the Beijing Human and Animal Environmental Center, Education Center, did a whole rally saying, show a face to the world during the Olympics that we are compassionate about animals. So everyone is trying to look at this, and I think it's because it's so high on the Chinese government's agenda, to miss that would be miss such a huge opportunity. The second opportunity, I think, despite the fact that the U.S. is not on the Human Rights Council, the U.S. is very active as an observer, from where we sit, we see the U.S. very active. So in the universal review process that will be discussed this month, China will be coming up for the universal review. This is an opportunity for the U.S. government to input into there and say, when China comes up, nobody wants to target, it has to be fair, everybody has to do the same thing, but there are some real suggestions about how that review could have some teeth. And that's where I think the government can sort of push for that, because that will be the vehicle for an international body to both review the record, as well as to make recommendations on what can be done and to work in a way in which China has some buy-in. And then the third thing is China's position on the Security Council is that you're seeing some odd transiting from China being just an obstructionist to really trying to take some leadership positions, you know, North Korea, some shifting on Sudan. So I think that those are opportunities, but that's geopolitics, which NGOs, that's not what we're expert at. And if I can say one last word on the cup half full, half empty, I've that proverbial expression, whether it's half, you know, is human rights better or worse. I think it's really important when we talk about human rights to look at it not only from the perspective of those where the cup is half empty, but those who have no cups. Because in China, we're talking about 300 million people who have no access to clean drinking water, literally. So when we talk about human rights and you say 300 million people have been lifted out of poverty, but 300 million people have no clean drinking water. 300 million at its most sort of conservative estimate, there's a growing middle class. However, all of the almost 90-something percent of the billionaires are party members, high party members, or their families. So when we talk about human rights, we really have to then center the human. We all like rights, particularly lawyers. We love the rights part. It's that human part. So how do we center the human part? And I think that we need to center it by looking at not the progress in terms of who's got stuff, who's the haves, but we really have to see the 700 million rural inhabitants who have no access to health care, the 300 million with no water, the access. So those left behind, that's, I think, the real test, is what happens to the least of us will be the test of progress.
That's true compassion. I hope all of you will join me in thanking Shark and Sharon for giving us a splendid performance today. Thank you.